All right, this is Kenny again here for part two of Time Traveler's Guide to Worlds to 2014. You might also know me as Simon Moon or the Duke of Scoops. Basically, I was originally planning on just doing this all in one part, but on getting about an hour and 20 minutes in and not even having reached the main thing I set out to do, which was basically to do a top 16 breakdown, deck breakdown, talk about all the players, you know, all the... talk about them, just like who they are, really like sit like immortal, trying to further immortalize their names in this, you know, tiny niche community, because I feel like that's all we really want in life is to just be able to like regale people with stories about one thing or another that we take pride in. And, you know, like one day I'll be telling my grandkids about how great a Netrunner I was, and they'll just be like, please, please, Mom, do we really have to listen to Gramps? And yeah, that's all I really want. So I'm gonna give all these people something to point to their grandkids about. See, this was a big deal. This obsessed weirdo who rambles for 2 hours thought I was cool enough to talk about. So anyway, as I was saying in the last end of the last episode, all these games, for the most part, were Team Covenant. I'm capturing them. There's a little bit from the Sansan group, which was the San Francisco group. You can actually listen to some videos of baby CTZ and baby Brian, along with baby John Del Sandri talking about Netrunner. They're pretty funny. I would recommend them. They're just sort of some really charismatic personalities. Anyway, so before getting into the top 16 breakdown, which I'm going to, as I was saying, just talk about people, the decks they played, what I think was wrong. I'm going to talk about that, which is 40% NEH, 10% Blue Sun, 10% ETF, 10% RP, 10% P, which is, you know, that's 80% of the field right there, and 5 IDs, which is partially a testament to just how few IDs, and but it also just really gives you an idea of, like, the sheer amount of NEH. People just sort of correctly pegging it as, like, this totally busted thing. And there's about one-third of each runner faction, 25% Andy, 20% Noise, 20% Kate. Again, kind of a testament to how few options there were. Your other options for NEH were Making News, which actually does some stuff unique, and like The World Is Yours, which is just, at this point, there's no reason to ever play it. All right, so for top 16, there's Niall Stanley, aka Hoo-Hoo. That was his stim hack, JNet. I'm actually not sure if he's ever on JNet, but Octagon name. He hails from the DC area. He's like a wild deck board builder. He shows up in a lot of older threads with some interesting ideas. It's a lot of uninteresting stuff. I remember in particular one time he beat me with Escher when I felt like I had like the game pretty locked up, and he just totally blew me out with Escher. So that was a particular deck building moment I remember from him. He was roommates with Ben Mason, played an absolute shit ton of Netrunner at this time. As well as Jesse Vandover, who actually come up surprisingly frequently in this world. It was like another person, and they all just played a ton and traveled to a bunch of events and were pretty good. And, you know, just a three-person triumvirate who were pretty strong in the early stages of Netrunner. He had top 8 at Worlds 2013. You know, it's still pretty impressive. Top 8 is pretty good, even if it was like, you know, a little weaker feel, a little smaller than future Worlds. And as I was saying, stapled the Octagon meta. You know, I remember him being on a ton and playing with a 10. He ended up sort of moving outside of the United States, I believe, to Chile. It's in 2016, I think it was. I think one of my favorite stories, I forget who told me this, but they told me that they thought him and Jesse Vandover were a couple, because at the end of every round, whoever was done first would, like, run over and watch the other person's game. And then they were just, like, they were, like, separated by having different opponents, and then as soon as the second they could be near each other again, they would not leave their side for all of the between rounds period, which I always thought was cute. And I remember being impressed. He was wearing some like really stylish short shorts when I met him in Philly 2015, which is the only time I ever met him. Anyway, so for his corp, he's playing RP. This is RP was like the first accessible Glacier deck. I think I talked about that a little bit. Invented by Dan Dargenio. And it was, basic idea was you have a bunch of econ assets that you stick and generate value over time to like fuel your economy. And if they trash your econ assets, then you're both poor because they have to run through like sort of good ice. And if they don't trash your econ assets, you sort of build a really expensive board really fast. And then you have defensive upgrades like Caprice to basically say, hey, you have to run through this taxing ice a bunch of times. I mean, Caprice was really the thing that let Glacier work as a strategy at that point. Just sort of, I say taxing ice, but there was only a few ice that was really even that taxing, which I'll talk about a little bit. One thing to note is there are not a ton of assets on this deck. There's 3x Sundew, 3x Mental Health Clinic, and 3x Jackson Howard, which is basically 6 plus Jackson Howard, which is just kind of his own category of thing, just sort of a universal thing in every deck. I think assets, if you read a lot of stuff from that time, people were asking for assets to be a little bit better a lot and stuff like that. I think people didn't respect the power of assets in a way we do now. There also wasn't that many great assets. I think this deck probably should have been running Pad, and I'll talk about that a little bit more as we go along, because there are a couple of RP decks in the cut. And so I want to spread out all my criticisms, but we're just sort of taking this as sort of the baseline RP deck right now, introducing it. Noticeably, it has 19 ice. That's the highest in the cut from this tournament, and is sort of 19 ice is pretty much higher than anything you'd see now, but it was still lower than last year's winner, which had a wild 22 ice. And just sort of reducing ice and increasing other kinds of cards, especially money, was like a big trend that happened over the course of Netrunner. It's just every world is the number of ice and the decks decreases. And then another thing is a lot of influence spent on ice, which Jintech makes sense, as I was talking about earlier. Just sort of Jinteki ice was a weak point of the faction, and they got a couple good ones, like it's running Tsurugi, which is pretty good, and it's running Kamainu, as well as it splashed for Ichi, which is a very good ice. And I think you see it here, and I think it's the only Ichi being splashed for, but it's actually a pretty common splash later in Arena, where it sort of acts as like a slightly worse Eli, which is still pretty good. And then you see the 3x Eli, which is going to be a pretty universal thing, is Eli was just far and away the best ice in Netrunner for like a long period of time. So it's for Corroder, which was basically 90% of the way people were breaking barriers at the time, it was 4 to break for 3 years ice. No other ice had that kind of ratio at that point in time. Everything was like, you pay 3 to tax them 2. And then if they click it, that's 2 clicks is like about as good as 4 credits, and you're only raising 3, and so even if you're like, they're bouncing, it's not really that huge of a tempo check. And then it has like 2 gear checks, I mean Tsubaku, which are just kind of there to sort of force them to install a Corroder, because you don't really need to install one for Eli. A lot of times you just want to click through it. And then Code Gates, you have like 2 categories of Code Gates basically. You have the Yawgmoth, which are Enigma and Yugura here, where you're sort of forcing a binary, and then you have the actual taxing one of Tollbooth, which is sort of the best taxing endgame ice by a mile for like sort of Netrunner. Basically, the thing with Tollbooth is one of the big problems with really big ice is you res it and it's really expensive, and the other person is just like, okay, I'm gonna bounce and then attack somewhere else. And so Tollbooth, you at least get them 3 back, and then there wasn't really ever a great way to break it outside of Femme. Like, even if they're like, hey, we're breaking with Yogg, so like 2 suckers and 3 credits. You can never, it's pretty hard to break Tollbooth for free. You know, like Femme is a 9 cost install, stuff like that. The best thing for like really taxing the runner with like a single piece of ice. And then the other one is Lotus Field, which had just come out earlier, sort of the end of the Yogg era, or the beginning of the end. Yogg is still pretty dominant at this point. What it's sort of, it's kind of weak outside of the fact it can't be broken by Yogg, which is a huge deal. You know, it's also at heart end the run, which is pretty useful. And then, like, there's 9 sentries here, which is, at that point in time, sentries were just sort of pretty taxing, you know. And one of the big things was a ton of subs was the main way you tax people, because it was a lot harder to cheat around subs than ice strength, where, you know, Data Sucker was very powerful at the time as a way to sort of, a lot of subs you can't really cheat it, as well as Atman was the other big one. And then Pup was very good at the time. It was, you know, 1 res, tax 2, and, you know, was a pretty good cheap way to sort of like make archives bad for RP's ability. And as I was saying, splashing Ichi Just kind of like a slightly worse Eli. And at the time, the main Century Breakers were Mimic, Fairy, and Femme. And so, and Atman, I guess. And that was kind of like most of what you'd ever see, as well as a Sharpshooter out of Shaper. And then, like, the agendas are 3 TFP, 3 NEPD, 3 Nisei. So, if you're doing math, that's 21 points, as is one more than you have to. But I think just sort of the sheer power level of TFP and NAPD, it was justified. TFP, I think, is correctly identified. If you had to play 21 points to get 3 TFP, you'd do it. I think 3 NAPD, also really good at the time. But I think if you had to redo it, you'd probably do the later RP agenda suite is 8, where you play 3 TFP, 1-5-3, 1 NAPD, and 3 Nisei, which is sort of, I think, the best RP agenda suite, and is a mild improvement you can make here. I think the one you play is Hades Fragment, which has the advantage of basically you can't lose to noise if you score it, which is can be kind of a rough matchup, and it's just a ton of value and just a really strong card. Downside is that it's a huge weakness to have it stolen, but I think it's better than playing the more agendas. Interns is kind of a cool card. Card's powerful, it's a lot of fun. Basically, you have a bunch of stuff that are pretty close. It can get you Caprice, it can get you Sundew. I watched one of the games and someone actually gets back Mental Health Clinic. Just sort of a little bit of value. You have a lot of choices. Like, a lot of times you'll see someone like overinstall Sundew to score, and then afterwards interns back another Sundew to sort of get their money back. I think this is like a card that's sort of well costed for a recursion card. It's hard to totally abuse. And it is generally, like, there's a lot of stuff that's pretty close, and it really depends on your situation, what you're bringing back. Ash is another splash here. I think people think Ash is really good here. It kind of makes sense in a lower econ environment. It's generally pretty hard to sort of, like, trash it and break the trace. I think it sort of is going to start to fall off a little bit after this, and, like, the Netrunner meta just sort of, later RPs are only going to play Caprice and just, like, not need the guaranteed thing of Ash. Having watched the games, I think it's kind of probably a little bit of overkill. It's cuttable. It's not bad, but it's cuttable. And then also, there's a Melange. This Melange should be a pad. You can't really... I don't know what this Melange is doing. It's goofing. I guess it's supposed to be, like, another Sundew, but I think it's just better to just, like, have a pad. And, you know, I think there's a lot of value in having more consistent econ that goes faster by playing some pads. All right, and then on the runner side, we got Prepaid Kate, which is, funnily enough, at the time was called the Pad Man. I don't know, you know, long history of terrible deck names in Netrunner. It was originally created by Spags. I looked up the initial version, and it had a 2x Polo Sympathy, which was not the, did not stay in the list for long. But, you know, the original list was, like, not that far from what we see now. Prepaid Kate had also won Gen Con that year. You know, Evil Canadian Benoit won, you know, which is probably one of the more humiliating Netrunner defeats in North America until sort of White Blades won 2 nationals in 1 year. Anyways, the general framework of the deck is you install one thing every turn, you play one event every turn, and then you have sort of 2 clicks to draw for econ, to draw more events and more things to play or make runs. Additionally, you're using some of the Shaper strengths, which is basically, at the time, is Clone Chip. So you have, you know, the ability to play really powerful cards a bunch of times. Usually this is either like a tech card, you can do like Sharpshooter, or you can do Parasite is probably one of the best ones, or Deus Ex for the Jinteki net damage matchup. You can basically never die against Ronins. And also Junebug basically doesn't do anything. And the econ was basically Prepaid Voice Pad plus events. You know, they're paying 6 influence for Lucky Finds, plus 3 Geisha Gambles, plus 3 Dirty Laundry. And then one of the big things is, and you have Levy, and so against like any age, you don't Levy, and you have sort of a standard deck that can move pretty fast. And against a Glacier deck, you'll be able to Levy sort of halfway through, and then you, on the second time through, basically you have all your breakers solved, and it's just straight value the second time while you have 3 prepaid, and so basically your deck just has like an econ engine that goes for a long period of time. Pretty cool thing Levy does in this deck, and one of the reasons Levy is so strong is that it sort of okay, just one dead card in a fast matchup and a long matchup, it basically, you know, gains, you know, shovels 9 econ cards back in your deck, which are each like letting you click to gain like 6 or 7. And so it's sort of your, for in a longer game, you know, it's basically like a 40 or 50 credit card. And then some specific notes about this list. You know, it's going to follow the general framework of prepaid. There's no clot yet. So basically the way you beat NEH is sort of a well-timed legwork. You try and legwork before they can score an Astro, and a lot of the game with a prepaid Kaden, or just in general, is about timing your legwork well before sort of the Astro is left to hand. And if you do it and not prematurely, so they like don't even have the agenda in their hand yet. So it's running 2 times, which I think was pretty standard at this point. And then the other thing is the Fractor, I forgot the name of the things that break a barrier, is Snowball here. Snowball is pretty bad, and I think it's the big thing that makes this deck a lot worse. You know, you're breaking Eli for 5, which is basically really bad. You know, you're breaking Wall of Static for 3, isn't even supposed to be a taxi nice, and so it's sort of, whereas once Lady comes out, you're breaking Eli for 1, and you're breaking Wall of Static for 0. Obviously, like, there's limited counters with Lady, but sort of Lady totally changes the matchup, where sort of and then also the deck becomes a lot more built about like Maker's Eye and indexing, where you just sort of say, okay, I'm not like doing RDI. I'm sort of based around sort of really getting in the servers just once with Lady for, and you know, can't really be kept out or taxed out. Notably, this list doesn't have Parasite, and it has 2 times Stimhack and 2 times Data Sucker. I think there should probably be a Parasite here. I think you're going to have some problems against RP if you don't have Parasite, and it's just a pretty good card. 2 times Stimhack, I would probably just cut both the Data Suckers. I think Data Sucker was considered really strong at that time. And I think a lot of the next year or so of Netrunner is going to be people discovering you don't actually need to run Data Sucker. And then Parasite is good on its own. Though obviously, like, Data Sucker Parasite is still a really strong combo. And basically, I think it was cut Parasite to have a better NEH matchup. Though I think Parasite is better than Data Sucker. It only has 2-time clone ship. I think this is just sort of a testament to the fact that you're not running Parasite and you don't really have Deus Ex or Sharpshooter. So you're not trying to play power cards over and over again. And you're using clone ship for sort of backup breakers, or just sort of one of the things you do in prepaid Kate often is you overdraw and pitch your breakers so you can sort of basically get them out during the run only when you need them. And you're not losing a ton of tempo by installing breakers when you don't have to, as well as being able to like stim hack them out. And you got 2-time Plascrete. There is a ton of Plascrete. It's not even like a particular meta that they're worried about. Everyone's just like, yeah, Plascrete's a really good value. And I think there's probably too much Plascrete. The one thing I will say about Plascrete is basically one of the things about Netrunner is like I think if you play well, prepaid Kate's gonna be like a 70-30 matchup with Wayland. And if you know you put in Plascrete, that goes to like a 80-20. You know, that's a pretty huge difference. And so you're just like, well, like if I, you know, put in the next spec econ card, I'm just only improving my NEH matchup by like 0.5%. So it's better to just like put in this thing and just gets a ton of util against Wayland. But I think this deck should just always be out money Wayland and should never really be taking tags. And I think it's just 2 wasted slots. Then there's 3 Quality Time, 3 Diesel. You know, this is going to be a pretty common theme for all the decks I'm talking about. But draw and setup was really seen as the key to beat NEH. Like, all you can do is set up faster to like prevent them from gear checking you on a remote. And also drawn to more multi-axis. There's a lot of people cutting like money or even like late game to get more tools against NEH, which I think is like pretty reasonable. I think there's some aspects of that I think was not totally well thought out. I think there was a general, this has become more true with the Andy deck. It's not really as relevant with sort of having more money actually lets you go a lot faster. And sometimes it's better to play good money card than it is to play a bad draw card, even if you're just trying to draw more cards. And then there's 3 Maker's Eye on top of like the 2 legwork, ton of multi-axis. There's 3 Same Old Thing. I don't really think this is correct. I think the idea here is it lets you sort of recur your events with prepaid for like more money, as well as being able to be more makers or more legworks. I think three is just too many. I think one is fine. And then you can play some more money cards or even just like play an indexing or an RDI or something like that. Prepaid Kate. I think this deck is just not there yet, pretty much entirely because of how much of an issue running Snowball is instead of Lady. Just like breaking Eli, which is, as I was just talking about earlier, is just the best dice in the game for five. It's just going to ruin you over the course of this tournament. They obviously, like, you know, Niles made the cut. There's some other prepaid Kates to make the cut, but I think it's not. It's just a huge liability. So the next guy is Brody Laudmill. Laudmill. I'm not 100% sure how to pronounce it, and I apologize. So who is he? He actually shows up a little bit in like Dan's World Report and a couple of other places as like the hot tub guy. Not the hot tub guy. He's part of the hot tub crew. He records an episode with Terminal 7 that you can listen to, episode 21, called Way Too Much Chlorine, which, you know, as I alluded to, sort of, it's part of what led me to believe that Worlds was just hanging out in a hot tub and talking about Netrunner. I don't really like hot tubs, I discovered. It's one of the things I learned from Netrunner, is I prefer to hang out on a couch. I'm a couch guy. You know, I like to stay dry. This podcast is really good. He's a really funny guy. Seems really nice. And the podcast really captures what Worlds is so much fun. Just like, you go into this kind of goofy, kind of shitty place with nothing there. There's like three restaurants. He talks about going to a grocery store that has carpets in it, which I agree with him, makes absolutely no sense in a place with as much snow as Minnesota. I don't know. I've never been to that grocery store. I kind of want to go. And it's just like, you have you have like very little transportation ability to go anywhere, but it's like incredibly fun because you're hanging out with a bunch of other obsessed weirdos and just like shouting at each other for hours about cards, which I guess is like what I'm doing here, is just screaming to the void about card choices from 5 years ago to recapture that magic of Worlds. Yeah, I don't, maybe you too will find yourself transported to a podcast or to a hot tub where you're just listening to, I think he talks about Dan and Jesse Manover yelling about Mr. Lee, and that sort of convinced him he needed to play more draw on his Andromeda, and that also Jesse Vandover convinced him that Mr. Lee was good. I don't agree with Jesse Vandover's opinion on Mr. Lee. I think Dan was correct in this one, but you know, Brody ends up making the cut, so maybe listening to Jesse wasn't the worst thing in the world. So anyway, I think to a certain extent Brody represents sort of like the dream of all of us, which is like, you're a pretty good local player. Sort of, you go to Worlds, you hang out with all these people, you sort of get the hot tech, and then you make the cut. You know, what's better than that? All right, so it's Corp NEH, our first NEH, one of many. You know, as I said, nearly 40% of the meta, and, you know, not unreasonably so. Basically, the basic plan is you fast advance the most powerful card in Netrunner history, Astro, and that gets you 4 points. Or sometimes even 6 points if you use that to score another Astro. And then you also have breaking news. You have two times breaking news. You're trying to get to 7. A 2-1 is basically worth 2 points. And so you just need to score breaking news, you score an Astro, and then you need to fast advance one on their agenda because you get another free one with Astro. And so you're really sort of relative to HP fast advance. You have to score half as many points. I think it's like a pretty good way to understand why NEH is totally broken. You have a pretty good ID now, and you have a bunch of extra influence, which we'll talk about what they use it for. And then you're also running NHPD, really powerful defensive. You know, 4 is a pretty meaningful cost in like the lower econ environment this world's happened in. And yeah, I don't miss Astrobiotics, having watched some of these games. But there's a lot I miss about this world. I kind of miss NAPD contract, you know, really having to think about whether or not you can steal an NAPD, or even the optional nature of it where you're just like, no, I can't afford the temple hit. It's going to put me too far behind on board. One of the things to note is that not a ton of assets here, just 3 pad, 3 marked. Then you got the 3 Jackson. And so even though you have an ability that synergizes with assets, you're not going crazy with assets. I think part of that, it's a mix of just sort of assets weren't that great and people sort of starting to get some of the good ones and realize you can play them. And also a mix of just sort of people were afraid of Andy. You know, Desperado security testing makes assets a lot worse. DBS isn't out yet, which is the other big asset that ends up seeing a lot of play in NEH. So the influence wise, you have 2x Biotic, again, Fast Advance, Astro. You know, the other card to use it is Sansan City Grid. Then you have 3x Eli's, which is best dice every deck's going to play. You have 2x Architect. This is like the first Architect NEH we're going to see. I actually forgot to mention that Niles is running Architect, which I think was a good call and was sort of ahead of its time relative to Dan's list. But yeah, this card is nuts. And then 2x Rota Turret, which I think was a pretty common splash before Architect came out into NEH. You know, an end the run Sentry. This card basically disappears after this because Architect is just so much better. It punishes people if they run into it without any programs installed. Whereas, like, if you res a Rota Turret and you just don't have a program installed, it feels pretty bad. And yeah, Architect is just better. And I think if Brody could probably play 3 Architect if he could take it back. The rest of the ice is like fairly standard. You have, you're going to see a lot of this. You have 3x Pop Up, which is another really good ice in the low econ environment, just sort of lets you move pretty fast. It's just like, it's not a great value to run through a pop-up to see one access. It just does enough to like change the logic of it. Also, if you get siphoned or go broke, you can still res it, which is pretty good. Then you got like 3 regular Kogates. You're gonna see a mix of Enigmas and Quandaries just throughout all these NEH. I think in general, Quandary is better in NEH, though they're pretty close. It doesn't really matter that much, I think. I don't have crazy strong opinions on which is better. Yeah, you generally have like 2 to 3 gear check, in this case 3, where you basically say, hey, you need to install a corroder. Here it's 2x wraparound and 1x wall of static. I think basically wraparound generally better, though there isn't a ton of AI you need to worry about. There's not a lot of Atman. And that's really the only good AI breaker. Mostly it's just sort of, I think, 1 credit cheaper, and you're not super concerned about taxing them, especially with all the data sucker around. So a lot of times the extra strength of wall static isn't relevant. I think this is a good mix. I think it doesn't matter that much. And you got 620 cards, Hedge and Sweeps. Sweeps is extra nuts against Andy when you get a turn 1. And you know, I think Sweeps is a big deal for MBN as a faction. Just way more consistent. You know, overall, this deck has 12 money cards, 3 pads, 3 marked, 6 of any con. Marked is like a lot better than you'd think it is. It's like not that much worse than a pad campaign. But I think it's, especially in like a slower environment, it's pretty good. And then probably one of the most important cards that made this deck so broken was Fast Track. Playing 2 of them. This card lets you find Gastro if you haven't. It lets you sort of Fast Advance out of hands, where you say like you have an Astra score, you Biotic, Fast Track, and then you can use an Astra token to score something. And it keeps you from R&D access as being too powerful with your weaker ice, and you can't just get countered by an R&D lock, which is a big way for the run out to win. That's the first NEH Fast Advance. I think it's worth watching a game. It's pretty stupid, and I remember being pretty stupid, and watching the games reminded me that it was pretty stupid. All right, and on the runner side, we got our first Andy. Andy was pretty much the best deck since Andy got released until probably like 6 months after this or so. Basically, just incredibly consistent. You played a lot of the most powerful cards at the time, and yeah, it was just, especially like in a runner favorite meta, it was just one of probably the most dominant single ID and deck of all time in Netrunner. So basically the core of the deck called Andy Suckers. I think if you want to look up some of the original versions, it was just called the deck, just because it was sort of the best deck that dominated it. General idea is Criminal just had a bunch of the best cards in the game. Account Siphon, incredibly powerful. Desperado, which is pretty much the best econ card. You know, just sort of in a lower power environment with worse ice, you could just like really get a ton of value out of it. And then you had Sec Testing and Data Sucker is the other things that really triggered on runs. And so you could, basically 1 click a turn, you're hoping to get a free run where you'd get 3 credits, a Data Sucker counter, which is kind of like somewhere between half a credit and a credit, and you know, sometimes even an access. You know, just really let you, and the goal of Andy is basically your ideal first turn is like Sure Gamble, Desperado, install Security Testing, install like Data Sucker, and then on turn 2 you start running, check their ice, force them to res it, and just sort of maintain power over the early turns to get a big econ edge. while you draw up, and then you have account siphon to force them to Ice HQ. You have stuff like emergency shutdown to sort of lock them in that early state of the game and just really run them over. And I think for the most part, the Andy decks in this top 16 are pretty similar. They have, you know, probably like 35 out of 45 all the same, just sort of the standard account siphon, sure gamble. Most of them have Dirty Laundry, Desperado, Corroder, Mimic, Universal. You play some fairies, you play some data suckers, you play security testing. And then after that, there's sort of a lot of stuff that swaps around the court. It's a lot of like switching econ options around. Oh, additionally, special order is sort of tutor, and it feels not as good as SMC because it's not on the run, but especially with fairy, where most of the hard at the time, most of the stuff you want to stop firing are sentries. And then, so I think some of the notable stuff about this are Gordian Blade is the code gatebreaker. For most of Andy Sucker's existence, you're using Yogg, and a bunch of lists, except 16 will be using Yogg, which I think is right. I think Gordian Blade kind of sucks, and it's three influence, and influence is pretty powerful here. Before this, people were running Parasite for the most part as some of their influence, and you're going to see that mostly disappear. Basically, usually to get more draw or more multi-axis and R&D interfaces. And a lot of times a second corroder for just consistency of being able to not get geotech the ground by Astro. You know, you sort of really need to go fast. This has two inside jobs. Inside jobs is kind of okay. It has two legworks. I think two is probably pretty good. You maybe want three to tech for Astrobiotics. Pretty powerful card in this meta. It's really tool against Astro is getting the legwork before they go off. Again, two-time Plascrete. I think it's a little bit better here than it was in Kate. I think this deck kind of needs to run, and so if you're afraid of Sea Source, you can kind of just totally fall behind. But I still think people are overtacked for Scorch. I think a lot of times you can play around by playing better. Some other things, like I was talking about with Mr. Lee, playing two Mr. Lee as the only draw cards here. Mr. Lee's kind of pretty awkward. I understand why you need it. I think it's probably bad. I would probably need to test more to like totally know. And most of the other draw options are locked behind influence. And then there's only two daily casts, which I think is a mistake. When I saw that, I was like, wow, it's a staple. But actually not playing the full amount of daily casts is like a thing that's fairly common. I think the idea was that your run econ was so powerful, you didn't need this extra stuff, and you'd rather have more burst econ. But I think daily cast is kind of really good. And there's two times Katie Jones. Katie Jones, huge at the time. I don't think Katie Jones is that great, and I think you should definitely be playing the third daily cast over the first Katie Jones. But I get, it's kind of lets you beat RP on a bad draw and kind of lets you beat Blue Sun. But for the most part, decks that didn't do anything for a while as the corp were pretty bad. And you can mostly just sort of, you don't really need that. Yeah, another thing is Passport one time. I think it's kind of weird with Gordian Blade, but Passport's pretty good. You know, it has some real downsides. But I think Passport is a real fun card because it sort of opens up kind of like a fourth gear check. But it works in Crim where the centrals are sort of a thing Crim can control and really force you to respond. R&D interface, I've talked a little bit about the idea of like R&D lock, which was a big idea at the time. Where you basically you have an econ setup where you can run R&D once every turn, and you keep them from ever drawing agendas, so you can sort of access all the cards before they can do anything with them, and they can never win, and you just get to, you know, their options are basically to draw a bunch of cards to beat you, and then you get to see even more cards, and they don't necessarily even have an agenda. But like I was saying, Fast Track sort of gets around that and was making that a little bit weaker at this point in time. But yes, this is Andy Sunker. There's a lot more of these that I'm going to talk about. Next up in 14th is Joe Held. He was maybe better known as Bazooka Joe on the forums. I remember seeing him around back when I started. I never met him. I'm not sure if he came to the... I don't think he came to the Next Worlds. But I think he was a big StimHack guy. And I think he was from the Portlands and Seattle area based on sort of creeping on his Netrunner DB decks. He unfortunately has zero games on stream, which is kind of a bummer. Him and Brody both don't have any games on stream. Feel bad about it. You know, I feel like I wish, you know, I would be kind of bummed if I made the top 16 and nothing was captured, which sort of gets back to what I was talking about with some of the problems with FFG running things, and not like totally be interested in sort of realizing that like part of what they're doing with organized play is like giving this fantasy to like people like me at the time that, you know, if you got really good at Netrunner or got lucky, you could like be on the stream and other people could watch you play and think you were doing cool stuff. And I think just sort of the facts they didn't personally record anything sort of always reflected me a little bit that really understand what the point of OP was. You know, it was like a form of advertisement for your game and to get people more invested and to stay part of the community. So I don't have crazy much to say about Joe Held. He seemed, you know, it's probably nice, I assume. I think he tested with Dan a little bit, and he was at RP, except with 54 cards, which was not good. You know, he lost on time in winner's bracket, and I think that not playing 54 cards probably would have mildly helped with that. You know, it's not totally direct, but I think it playing with, you know, your shuffle times a little bit better, and just you don't need to play that much faster to not lose on time when you're probably like a turn. And to get to 54, he was played 2 TFP, 2 Feudal, which gives him the exact point total, but I think TFP is a lot better than Feudal. I don't really think you want to be playing Feudal in this deck. That's a lot worse than NAPD because you're mainly taxing on credits, not so much on cards. And then 19 ice as well, but he is, you know, he's 5 more cards, so it's actually a little bit less tech. Similar sort of thing. Tollbooth, Enigma is like the code gate, gear check and a quandary, and then 3 pups, 2 lotus fields, 3 Sarugis, and then I forgot to mention this, but Niles didn't have Kamino. Joe's Kamino. I think Kamino is a lot weaker than Sarugi here. I think neither of them are actually that great, but I think Sarugi, problem with Kamino is they can just be like, okay, I'm gonna take all the net and just run through this for free, which I don't really see anyone doing, but I think it's something you should be doing against this RP, which I think gets to a thing that will come up a little bit, that the scouting differences between this and later worlds is really noticeable. Where I think even in later worlds, people pretty much know what the person they're playing against is on, and it makes a pretty big difference in play and sort of kind of stuff you can get away with. And it makes stuff like Kamino a little bit worse, whereas like I would guess that people were actually playing around Snare even though the list had totally been published. And he's actually playing 2 pad, which I think is pretty good. He's playing 2 interns, and then he's playing 3 times enhanced login protocol, which I think is pretty good. I watched some of the streams and it was doing a lot of work. I think it's pretty good against Andy. It's, you know, as I was saying, it's like was really the only playable card at the time. But yeah, I think the card really shuts down Andy and is pretty good, and that's like the main thing you're trying to do. Especially like at the very start of the game, Andy's trying to run all over you, and if you have just like 2 pups and ELP up, it's sort of everything gets a lot worse. The security testing gets worse. You know, it's sort of instead of a click for 3, it's 2 clicks for 3, which is really not even that much better than clicking for credits. You know, it's got pads, which I think are pretty good. And it doesn't have Ash, which I think based on watching it, I think the ELP or better ice is sort of a good call. And so I think there's actually a lot I like about this list, with the single exception that I don't think you should be playing this agenda suite, and I don't think you should be playing 54 cards. And I think there's actually outweigh the things I like about it, which are the pad campaign and the ELPs, and I think no Ash I like. But I think I would say this is like a little bit worse than Niles just from the 54, and I think those decisions made here, but I think there's a lot to like about this. So then for the runner, we got Andy, the classic. It's actually 41 out of 45, the same as Birdie's was, which I think is kind of a reflection of how much people have been playing this. I think they ever diverges a little bit in sort of how they respond to the changing meta of NEH. So the changes are we're losing 1 Plascrete and the daily casts, and then we're getting 2 bank jobs and 2 same old things. So the bank jobs I think are pretty good. Bank jobs is a pretty good card. I'm not crazy about the same old thing. I think the extra siphons aren't amazing, and people are mostly playing around it well, and it's just a little bit worse than the straight up siphon and isn't as powerful. Basically, I think, you know, I've talked a little bit about daily cast. I think playing 0 daily cast is wild, and I think it's a lot better than Katie. Actually, I did a breakdown of it. So basically, if you unload Katie after 5 turns, so that's Katie has 15 credits on her. You're netting 2 credits over installing a daily cast and clicking for credits, except you don't have that. You've lost a bunch of tempo, and actually the clicks are a lot better than a credit. So I would say you're really wanting to get like 18 off before Katie's better than daily cast. And there's a lot of ways in which it's just always going to be, that's a huge tempo hit. And so I don't know. I think people are like overly obsessed with the infinite value of Katie, and they sort of miss out that like netting 4 credits from a daily cast that you can pretty much start using right away. Basically, you install daily cast, you're 3 credits down that turn and a click. Next turn, you're 1 click down and 1 credit down. So you're a little bit behind on what you could do if you hadn't installed daily cast. Turn after that, you're neutral. The corp really has like 1 turn to respond with it and like to take advantage of the tempo loss from installing daily cast, which is sort of like the turn after they see you install. They're like, oh, okay, I need to do something on this turn because they'll have like 2 credits less to respond, which isn't even that much and isn't really a huge window. Whereas Katie, if you install Katie, basically what you're saying is for the next like 4 turns, I'm going to be like 8 or 9 credits down from where I would be if I hadn't done this. And that's a lot. We're talking about a meta where being able to steal an NAPD is a big deal. And it really is just sort of this huge tempo loss and for something that's not even that much more efficient. So actually, like if you watch all the cut games that are on stream, here are the values that Katie Jones gets. There's a 3 credit Katie Jones, which is basically if you do a 3 credit Katie Jones, you're just straight up losing 2 credits. Yeah, so you're just like losing a ton of value. Next one was 6, which is it's technically neutral, but sort of it's the same as clicking for credits. And you included a card. And if that was a daily cast, you would also be neutral, except you'd have more credits on the next turn after that. And the other one was 18. Except the game where this happens, the runner ends up losing the game with 32 credits, and where they just didn't have enough clicks to like find their breakers and install them, and they would have been way better served by having a little bit less money, but having enough clicks to install all their breakers and find them all sooner. I think there's like a I think one of the big things you can do to improve the Andy list at the time is to keep playing 3 daily casts and no Katie Jones. I played against RP with Katie Jones. It's actually not even that good. Sort of if RP gets a really bad draw, it will kind of you can get a ton of value and just kind of win. But for the most part, RP has a good draw where they're sort of like, okay, you need to track. Like if they have a mental health clinic, even like 1 mental health clinic going, they're sort of getting ahead in the neutral board state. Where you're like, yeah. So if you like think about like the neutral, like a neutral board where it's like, you're kind of doing stuff, it's sort of like, and your actions are kind of canceling out. Katie Jones is probably worth like 1.5 credits a turn at most, and like that's about the same as a mental health clinic because credits are a little more valuable. So like your Katie Jones is like getting counteracted by mental health clinic, and if like they have a pad or a sundew going, you're getting way behind by trying to econ race them. And so you kind of just have to be getting more value than Katie Jones is giving to win like a drip race. And that's I think Katie Jones like on the stream games straight up like loses 1.5 games in the 3 games it's played, and I would guess that it probably loses one or two more. It really tricks you into thinking it's getting a lot more value than it is. But the like initial cost of like installing it for a click and 2 credits, plus just sort of the turn where you unload it makes the value a lot worse than the click for 3 credits that you think you're getting from it. Next up in 13th is one John Dalessandri, aka Cyrus. Say something. So this was double in bracket. So 13th through 16th, all the same record, which was 0 wins and a limb. But they were basically ranked based on their Swiss standings. So John Dalessandri, there's a lot I can say about him. He's from California. He won the California regional that year. One of them. There might have been two. California is a big state. He was rocking his Matthew Stafford jersey, number 9 on the Lions. So I think he does in a lot of the big cuts he's in. I gotta say, this was a good year for John. World's top 16. Lions did end up going 11-5 into a first round playoff loss. Which is, as Lions go, about as good as it gets. They beat the Bears on Thanksgiving. Just absolutely crushed them. Megatron, aka Calvin Johnson, maybe the best wide receiver, at least top five of all time, had not yet pulled his Barry Sanders and was still playing for the Lions. Good year to be John. I've talked to him a bunch of times since then. He's a pretty good friend of mine now. Real nice guy. He's a pretty strong player, and as he did last time I talked to him, he insists on putting bad cards in all his decks. And then insists he got unlucky, but basically his losses always come down to just his bad card choices. I think he's a little underrated as a player. He's a lot of top 16s. He's won a couple of regionals. Pretty strong guy that is self-deprecating and really would trick you into believing he was going 4-12 every tournament. Kind of the opposite of how he talks about the Lions. I think one of my favorite moments with him was just like him insisting to me that the Lions were built to destroy the Green Bay Packers. And over the last 5 years, you can just look it up. And, they were just destroying them. I looked it up and they were 5-5. And John was like, well, like two of those don't count. One of those, Matthew Stafford was hurt, and in one of those, the refs were terrible. I was like, okay, John, wasn't Aaron Rodgers hurt in one of the other ones? And he was like, no, which is, I think, the John Dalessandri Lions classic. Just poor guy, just like you feel bad for him putting all these bad cards and losing and insisting it's not that. You kind of got to feel bad for him for always rooting for the Lions and being like, ah, they got unlucky. No, it's just you made a bad life choice by rooting for the Lions. That's really all there is to it. Anyway, for court, he's got an NEH. There's going to be a lot of John's classics here. He's got a Singleton snare with no scorched earth. I guess if you believe you're really bad, that you need someone to like randomly walk into the snare, this is like a reasonable play, but he's not. He's got the standard agendas. He's got, three pad, three mark, three Jackson. He's got two biotic. And then he has a little bit of tag punishment in there. He's got to close the counts. General consensus, best tag punishment at the time. You're usually trying to punish Andy for floating the siphon tags. He's also got a psychographics, which I think there's a deck at the time where you mid-season psycho Beal. It was not great, I don't think, and sort of relied on the corp, the runner being a little silly. Because I think the corp econ was not actually there to like out econ the runner if they were playing smart. And to build off his tag punishment, he's three times data raven. But then only 13 ice. So you may be noticing some problems here. You got three times data raven, you only have two tag punishment, and neither of them, win you the game on the spot. So your opponent can just kinda flip tags, and then you have eight ice, which is not very many. And if you watch this game against the lad, he pretty much loses because Elad has four credits and just has an HQI and is able to run through into HQ a bunch of times and steal an NAPD. And so even a quandary would have sufficiently taxed Elad to not lose there and not be able to steal an NAPD. So I think if you just built this deck a little bit better, he would have won that game. Yeah, I mean, he insists he got unlucky, but I checked the tape, and that's John. Great guy, but insists that the Lions lose because they got unlucky and not because a series of bad choices. Then for his runner, he's got prepaid Kate. He's got some John specials in it. I think my favorite is the two time replicator, two times diesel. And he's like, I would have won that game if I'd drawn my prepaids, but I didn't. It's like, okay, maybe if you included a third diesel instead of these stupid replicators, you would be drawing them more often as well as a third quality time. He's got a test run, which I think was like reasonably common at the time. Not great. You can put a third astrolabe in to be able to draw it more consistently. Yeah, I don't know. He's got an imp, which is kind of interesting to include, I guess, trying to get rid of Astras. I think just the second legwork and being smart about selling the Astras is a little bit better. He has a Akamatsu Mem chip.
that should just be the third Astrolabe. You know, it's kind of the best NEH stack card for K8. You know, draws you a ton. He's also got three sample things. Feel like I'm going crazy. Like, I don't know why they're doing this, especially since John does not have a stim hack. I think, like, you know, if you're running stim hacks, you can kill some Sansans. You know, just like, this deck just doesn't have enough money, doesn't have enough draw, because we need to play a replicator, two replicators, a mem chip, a test run. You know, just play the good cards, John, please. I'm just like, yeah, I didn't even know him then. I think I first started becoming friends with him in 2016. But I remember him just like finally convincing him to play good deck in this one tournament, and just like, I'm getting him to play Andy. It's a real deck. I gave him 45 cards. He's like, he keeps on trying to like play his bad cards. I'm like, no, John, just play these 45. And then I have to like watch as he installs a doppelganger on stream and then wins the stupid tournament. And that was like maybe the worst thing that ever happened to John, because you know, it's like the Lions going 11-5. They trick you into thinking there's hope, when really the best thing for him would be to lose all hope, just totally despair, and listen to me. And we, you know, I can build him up like a coach. And that's, you know, there's an alternate universe where he's like world champion, you know, just because I was in his life a little bit earlier and explained to him. Just play the good cards, John. Yeah. John, I love you, but... All right. Next up at 12, and so this is the break point for one win in the cut, is Jesse Marshall. Jesse Marshall, probably most well known for hosting the Winning Agenda, which is kind of like the first competitive focused Netrunner podcast. And he was the Australian national champion, which I think this is our first international competitor, which I think is pretty cool. I think relative to last Worlds, this Worlds was a lot more international. Not as international as was to come. You know, I think it's always been pretty hard to get to Roseville, Minnesota from Australia. But it's still really cool to see people from all around the world in this. And I think this was where FFG gave hotels, but not flights. I'm not 100% sure. I guess not flights, because, yeah, it's a lot of money for them to drop, actually. It's kind of like a problem, but so it goes. And you can actually listen to some of the early episodes where he talks about going to Worlds. Winning Agenda 7, I listened to it. Took some notes about what he said about his decks, his thought process. I had actually looked at his deck first and then went back and listened to it. And there's some of what he says that I actually had figured out, which I'll talk about. And it's a cool thing to sort of, I mean, it's one thing to listen to me talk about like what these people were thinking, why these cards are here, but it's cool to have someone at the time talk about it. And then I'll get into his decks. So his corp is HB Fast Advance. I'm not unconvinced that Jesse Marshall was attempting to attend 2013 Worlds and fell into a time loop on the way flying there and accidentally arrived on 2014 and just pretended that he didn't miss a year. Because HB Fast Advance was probably the best deck at the last Worlds, won last Worlds, and is just not as good as NEH Fast Advance. I think basically the trade-off for NEH versus HB Fast Advance, HB Fast Advance, you get a little bit richer, you get a little bit better ice, but you're not playing Astro, and instead of Breaking News, you're playing Director Haas Pet Project and Gellhan's Archaeology. I guess Arcology, that's not a fucking word. I don't refuse to believe it. It's always been Archaeology in my head, which is way cooler than whatever the fuck Arcology is. You know, like the idea of like feature archaeologists being really important and making lots of money. But anyway, so basically you have to fast advance about twice as many agendas, which is sort of, you know, you're talking about, that's probably, you know, right there, you know, you're four turns slower at least, and you know that means you need to res more ice to give up less accesses, and you're, you know, 14 credits down, so it's a lot worse. And it's this deck is pretty definitely worse than MBN Fast Advance in my mind. And then the other agendas besides the 2-3 ones I mentioned our NAPD contracts, you know, universal still. Accelerated Beta Test, which is kind of hard to fire in this deck. And then Project Vitruvius, which at the time was basically played as a 3-2. I think its over-advancement ability became very big in later Netrunner.
But for a long time, everyone was like, oh, it's a 3-2, and that's the best a card can ever be. You know, 3-2s were just a huge deal, and I think a lot of people thought HB and MBN were just going to be the best factions forever until the other factions got the same amount of 3-2s. Assets, Adonis Campaign, pretty good. You know, pretty good money source. Deck is a lot richer. Jackson Howard. We got the ice. There's some interesting choices here. First off, there's 3 Roto Turret, no Architect. I'm pretty sure if you ask Jesse Marshall now, he would tell you that was just wrong. And that he was like, oh, he was thinking like the old man, he needs a gear check. But Architect in this deck is insane. You get back Sand City's grid, you install ice, you get back Adonis, ton of value. And, you know, just a way better card than Roto Turret. And basically nobody plays Roto Turret much longer after this tournament, except for in like certain fringe cases. He's got an Itchy, again, sort of just kind of a worse Eli, which is still really good. 3 Elis, always. 1 Ice Wall, which is really not that great of a card. I'm not totally sure what you could do with that influence, but there's got to be something better than this. 3 Paper Wall, which is kind of an interesting include. Vanilla isn't out yet. I guess it's okay. I think it's kind of interesting. It's got 1 Quandary, 2 Enigma, which I think is a reasonable spread. Again, just sort of like gear check pressure. And then 3 Victor 2.0. I don't know what is happening there. I listened to his podcast and he said it was great. I don't know what people are doing. This deck card is not good. I've played a bunch of it. It's not that hard for people to get Yogg through it. They can just click through it. You know, it's a lot more to res. And you can be playing, I feel like, at least 1 influence for a Lotus Field here and probably 2 Lotus Fields. Makes a lot more sense to me. I don't know. And I watched this game versus Ben Mason, where Ben Mason just siphons him through, legworks him through it. It is 1 bad sub and 1 okay sub on like a clickable thing. You know, there's no face check pressure. It's a huge tempo loss. As opposed to Ichi, where like usually like you're sort of tempo neutral when they run into it. Like with this, you're, because they have to like click through it, and you're like a little out of tempo, but it's not a disaster. This is like, you're kind of way down. You know, they pay 1 to not take a brain, or even they just take a brain. It's not that big of a deal. The Fast Advance tools, you have 3 Biotic, 3 Sansa City Grid, so you have 1 more Fast Advance tool than any age, but you need to have Fast Advance twice more. So it's kind of, yeah, it's kind of like you really kind of have worse Fast Advance tools than any age. You have 2 Shipment from Sansa as a kind of a money card. That seems fine. I feel like one of these should be like a second Lotus Field. You have 3 green level clearance. I think it's, I don't know about that one. I don't really know what I replace it with, but green level clearance is not very good. Blue level clearance is slightly better than green level clearance, but it's kind of just like, even at the time, was not that great. So I feel like this deck is okay, and it's kind of like the deck that was the best deck for a while, but it's just way underpowered compared to any H Fast Advance or RP, and kind of like when you watch this game, you can kind of tell. And then for the runner, the other deck from the 2013 meta is Atman Kate. First instance of it I could find of someone coming up with this was Justin K on Board Game Geek. It looks like he's the guy who invented it, so props for that. Basically, the idea is Atman is a pretty good breaker. Use Atman with Data Sucker support plus Parasite to handle all the ice pretty efficiently. You know, you never have to worry about strength again. You know, I think Atman was a pretty interesting breaker. So you have like, you generally need to install 2 Atman and then have Data Sucker support. So you still have like 3 or 4 cards, just like a traditional baker suite. And it has its own set of weaknesses and own set of strength. And I think Atman is one of the big AI successes in that runner, where it's sort of like, okay, Atman is good against different stuff and gives you a different consideration for your ice. You're like, okay, I need to like think about, oh no, I have too many 4 strength dice, so maybe I'll include this other thing. And I really miss, like, I think Catman was a pretty cool deck, even though it's like sort of using a very similar econ to like the AND, where it's Desperado plus Sucker on econ, which is sort of like, this was the best stuff at the time. The one thing I noticed is I don't understand how this deck isn't running Stimhack. I thought Stimhack was core with Atman. You know, like, you kind of need Atman at 4. You're stim hacking out an Atman, and that basically gets you exactly an Atman at 4. Also has no Parasite, which I thought was core to this deck. I guess I understand where it's coming from in the NAH meta, but I think you're losing like 15 or 20% of the RP matchup, which I think I listened to
the podcast, and Jesse said about the same, was that if he could put a Parasite back in if he could, because I think just like I don't know how you beat RP without it.
It looks like solidly built. I think it's just a little like out of date for the meta, but it's not terrible. And I think also like the runner was the weaker side in this meta, so it's sort of, you know, playing a mediocre corp deck is kind of just makes it impossible to win, because you know you kind of need to win every corp game to be able to win in this tournament. And that has just a ton of multi axes, 2 legwork, 3 maker's eyes, 2 indexing, and 3 RDI. That's the most I've seen in any of these decks. I think it's maybe slightly overkill, but just like, you know, everyone was like, okay, all you can do is access race any age. That's the only plan you got. So I think it's reasonable. Indexing, I think, was not that huge at the time. I guess people didn't want to check for Jackson's money, sort of standard neutral package, daily cast, gamble, dirty laundry, and then Proco, which I think is a pretty good card. And then 3 times modded, which is interesting. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know what else you're going to put in here at a certain point for money, but I think probably 2. But you have the 3 RDIs. Maybe it's right. Breaker is basically 3 Atman. Deus Ex gives a good PE attack. No Levy, though, so I think it's going to be down on the PE decks, but it's hard to say for sure. It's got a Corroder. I think the main thing you want to be doing with Corroder is breaking wraparounds, but I think it's worse than 2 times Stimac or Parasite. I think it's just like, it's like in this deck with like, you're breaking Eli with Atman, you're breaking, you know, you're trying to break everything with Atman. So it's like, you're fine with Snowball. I think it's just worse than 2 times Stimac. 2 times Flaskery, I just still like, don't understand. Like, I've played against the Wayland decks. They don't have Audacity yet, so they're just like kind of, like, if you kind of just like make a bunch of money, they're just like, oh, I guess you win. Like, you know, as long as you don't like run on the fourth click and hit a snare, you kind of just win. I don't understand how people are dying to Scorch, but I think, you know, they were so used to be running so far ahead. It was like, well, you might as well make it 100 and just like turn your brain off, which is, yeah, honestly pretty understandable. All right, then up next in 11, again, also 1 and 2 in the cut, is Tomasz Fedorczyk. He was the Polish national champion, the first European in the cut. I think Europe in general is interesting, or continental Europe, which is generally how I'll refer to Europe from now on. When I say Europe, I mean continental Europe, as opposed to specifically the UK. Europe has always been interesting because it's naturally divided in a way a lot of other places aren't, by language, even though, you know, it's actually like Poland and sort of Germany are a lot closer than, say, the Northeast is to Seattle. And I think probably they're even closer, just by absolute distance from like New York to like Minneapolis, not even considering like the superior public transportation of Europe. But they also have sort of these national divisions of language, where there's a lot of countries aren't as big and sort of people prefer to speak their language. You have a lot of different metas, and it's a lot more fractured and less unified than the US, as well as just sort of having to rely on like translations. You know, oftentimes translations would be bad, because I'm not 100% sure FFG does it, but there's still been a notable amount of continental European players are pretty good, and actually in like modern Netrunner, I think they're one of the strongest groups of players. It's always fun because they tend to have a lot of their own forums that they talk on, and so have seen when they'll show up with a like totally wild idea that nobody in any of the English speaking communities has seen. They will say, Tomasz, aka Selverin, did talk fairly frequently on the StimHack forums and play in like a global meta. I saw him on JNet and Octagon a fair amount. I think he was in StimHack League a bunch. You know, he ended up winning. He was top 8 at the Store Championship Invitational in 2015. He won the Polish National Championship again in 2016 with some pretty cool decks. And you know, he has some really interesting decks here, and I think is a pretty great deck builder. Pretty great deck builder, pretty great player. I think he plays until, I'm not 100% sure if he's still playing now, but he played for quite a while. I mean, he's playing at least until 2017, I believe. And yeah, really, really like seeing you know, this is like really the first international tournament, you know, with a lot of people from all over the place, though it's still predominantly people from the US plus a bunch of national champions who FFG gave, I believe, just hotels, but it might have also been flights for. Anyway, so for his corp, he's playing Tenon, which is like a, I think, a totally wild and no one was expecting this really. And it's basically a Glacier Fast Advanced deck, which I think, not 100% sure if this was like, people always thought of that Fast Advanced is fast, but the general idea is you build up a, you know, you are only ever icing centrals, and then you Fast Advance all your points and just sort of make it really hard to get in, so your ability gets come on, and then you can Fast Advance with Trick of Light. The agendas suite are interesting. It's 10, and you basically have your 3/2s, Brain Trust and Philotic. You got three of those. You got Medical Research, or just Medical Breakthrough, which is a 4/2, and then the second one's a 3/2, and the last one's a 2/2. So it's you're pretty, you know, it's generally not that much better than a 3/2, but the upside of being able to get a 2/2 is pretty huge. You got Clone Retirement, which is the Jinteki 2/1, which I always thought was a really cool card. I loved playing Clone Retirement, you know, partially because I loved playing Archer out of Jinteki. And I think the BP aspect of it is pretty cool. And it's like slightly relevant here when you're playing Grim, which gives you a BP. And you know, you're in Glacier decks, so BP is pretty bad. And you got 2 TFP, which is basically super strong. I think there's like a, and I think it's pretty hard to have enough fast advanceable points with 3 that's still worth considering. In my opinion, though, I think it makes getting enough points you can actually score kind of hard. You can actually fast advance TFP with Biotic, Trick of Light. The only asset is Jackson Howard. Again, you don't really want to be making remotes, but Jackson Howard gets rid of itself and is pretty powerful for a deck that is kind of a combo deck. It needs to like set up a bunch before it can score points, and you don't want to get stuck with a bunch of agendas in hand. Ice-wise, the main Tenon ice are 3 Ice Wall, which is like pretty good, though it's a little weak to Femme. And then 1 Tyrant, which I think is, you know, I'm constantly getting people with the fact that this deck is Tyrant. Could be able to say, oh, it's really bad. It's like, well, Tyrant's a top 16 Worlds card. You know, like I think like probably like 60% of the card pool can't say that. And so it's arguably a lot better than stuff. You know, I think part of that is we're talking a lot about how none of these Andy decks are running Parasect anymore. And it gets pretty bad in any meta with Parasite, but there's really not a lot of it. And then the other bear you got is Wall of Thorns. I understand where this is coming from. It's still a really bad card. You should not really ever be playing Wall of Thorns. I'm not 100% sure what you should replace it with, but yeah, it's bad. And then for Centuries, you got Grim and Tsurugi, which I think Tsurugi makes a lot of sense here. Grim is pretty good here. You know, the main way people are getting through Grim is with Data Suckers, and you're really locking that down with a, you know, by sort of shutting, you need to shut off all 3 centrals, including Archives. So you can't really be letting people in with get Data Suckers, and Grim is like, gets super strong here in an environment where people are playing Mimic for the most part. And then you got Quandary and Lotus Fields. You know, again, sort of this is like a Yogg setup. I'm not sure if like there's something that should be played here. I don't 100% know what I would play over like Wall of Thorns, but it's not. I mean, I would at least play like 3rd Tsurugi over 1st Wall of Thorns. Operation wise, as I talked about, there's the fast advance ones. There's Trick of Light and Biotic Labor. Biotic Labor is 4 influence, but I think gives you a little bit, just enough tools. You know, you don't need to go crazy fast. You kind of got a pretty good end game. It has a ton of money. It has 3 Hedge, 3 Celebrity Gift, 3 Restructure. I think these are the only Restructures in the cut, which is kind of, Restructure is kind of a low-key cool card because of how hard it is for the corp to stay high, because you're so vulnerable for the most part if you're floating a ton of money. And then it's got 2 Medical Research Fundraisers, which is kind of just an okay card. It's not like great value, but I can see why you'd be playing it here. You know, he's playing all the money cards he can for the most part. And then 3 Commercialization. This card is a it's really not that good. I think three is probably too many. I think a lot of times by the time you're really getting the high value, the game's kind of over. You know, it's one for each advancement token, so it's you're getting hedge fund value starting like four turns into the game at best, and it's probably a lot worse than that. Especially if you're like trick of lighting, or you know, you don't have an ice wall at first and then you later do it, or the you know, you're playing against Andy and they're making a lot of successful runs. And then you got Caprice Nisse, two of them. Makes a lot of sense. There's probably like an argument where there should be like an interns in here or something, or maybe a third one of these. But just, you know, you're probably putting this in HQ like 90% of the time, just shut down siphons and all that. Chrisium Grid is actually in the card pool at this time, so I think that's another thing you can potentially be playing here. You know, it's pretty rough. You know, just totally shut down Andy. You know, they have to, you know, a lot of Sneak Tour beta in the cut, so that's like one concern with Caprice on HQ. But I think overall this deck is like pretty good. I think it's probably worse than the other stuff, but I think it's better than the ETF Fast Advanced deck. And I haven't actually played with this. No one really played it after that. I think it was like a pretty good meta call though. It's hard for me to totally say how great this deck was. I think one thing to note is, you know, so Tomas is 1-2 here. I think both of his losses were on his runner side, which is a fairly frequent thing that happens. So there's a lot of parts of evaluating this meta that are kind of hard when it's just a really court favored meta. And so you can say, well, he came in 11th with this deck, it can't be that good. Well, he didn't actually lose a game with it. So like maybe this was low key like the right meta call. I don't think it was, but I think it's better than the ETF deck. But it's hard to totally say without sort of playing it in an environment against a lot of these other decks. On the runner side, we got another wild pick, which is Opus Chaos Theory. Magnum Opus is sort of a longtime archetype of Shaper. Basically, you want to set up a board state where all you can do is click on Opus, mostly click, so you want to set up fast and then click on Opus. And then the wrinkle about this one that people might not be familiar with is Personal Workshop. Personal Workshop was actually the first instant speed card that let you install things during the run, which is a huge deal. We think of like Clone Chip as the main one now, but this Personal Workshop actually came first. It was the reason people were like, wait, what is this timing windows of a run thing? Like, this was actually like a totally game-changing card. It mostly ended up getting outpaced by other cards, but is a pretty cool card. It sort of combines the ability to do instant speed stuff with dripping one a turn, as well as, you know, the big combos with Stim Hack, which basically turns a Stim Hack into just a pure gain 9 no matter what your opponent is doing. So then general gist of this card is you draw really fast, you get 3 diesel, 3 quality times, put a bunch of stuff on Personal Workshop and Stim Hack it out, and then click Mopus a ton. It's got 3 actually, which I think was right. One, you kind of need Mem in this deck. 2, yeah, NEH is probably the worst matchup for Mopus deck. Though I think RP isn't that great either. The other thing to note is there's no Sure Gamble, which I'm not 100% sure if that's correct, though. I don't 100% know the cut. It's probably Test Run. Test Run really doesn't feel that great to me here. I know you want to be able to consistently get Magnum Opus, but you're a 40 card deck, you got SMC. And then for multi-axis, there's a ton of it. Big theme, 3 Maker's Eye, 3 R&D interfaces, which I think seems good to me. You're pretty good at getting R&D interfaces out. 3 Maker's Eye, you know, just max axis against NEH. And then 3 Legwork. Like 3 is maybe unnecessary, though. You're not really desperate to use the influence in this deck. The influence spread looks pretty good to me. You know, 2 Corroder, 1 Mimic, 1 Femme, and then 2 Gordian Blades. So you're getting set up pretty fast and pretty consistently. So this deck feels like pretty well tuned. There's one same old thing. I don't totally know what this is for. I guess it's for, you know, most of the time Maker's Eye, sometimes Stim Hack. I think the thing I would like to do with this deck is try and get some Sure Gambles in, just a little more consistency on your Opus starts. But yeah, I think this deck's pretty good. I watched it I watched it play one game against Dave Hoyland. It didn't totally get blown out, though. I will say Dave Hoyland was playing an NEH deck with Scorch instead of Biotic, and I think that changes things a lot. The game was actually pretty winnable. I think Tomas missed an NAPD that was like on the that had been installed pretty early, and I think was could be pretty obviously deduced was an NAPD at a certain point when Dave scored using a Sansan from a different server, indicating that he wasn't using the Sansan in the ice server, so kind of only can be NAPD at that point. But and he also Dave's scores a Beal that he just sort of naked advanced. It was just kind of understandable to not check that with the Mopus deck. It's pretty costly, especially if you're not playing on trashing pads. But I think it was like a very winnable game by Tomas. I don't actually think this deck is that much worse than a lot of the other runner decks. I think it's a pretty cool meta call. He's able to get a lot of accesses against NEH. And is, I think it's a pretty solid deck. Next up, coming in at 10th, is Kenji Jap. I don't know a ton about him. I know he's from SoCal. I asked John Del Sandri about him. John said he was a pretty good Netrunner player, super nice, which I think, what more do you want to say? He stopped playing pretty soon after this. I found his Reddit account, and he had like a couple of comments about his decks, and then basically never posted again. And based on what John told me, I think he quit Netrunner after this. But, we're dedicated to Everin's moment of glory, so we're gonna talk about his decks. So his core up is Jinteki P. It was never published. I'm actually just gonna use this as a chance to talk about the original P list from Chris Henke's, generally called Cambridge P because it won the Cambridge Regional. And Chris called it Jinteki 15.5. I don't know exactly how his number system was working, but 15.5 gives you a pretty good idea of how long he's been working on it. Chris Henke's played it at the 2013 Worlds and came in 32nd. And I think this list is interesting. It was basically, Jinteki was considered pretty bad for most of the first year and a half of Netrunner, and pretty rightfully so. It had terrible ice, it had terrible money, had Nisei Mark II, but didn't have anything else to do with it, and didn't really have enough. All the net damage cards were not getting enough value, and it was just pretty bad. So I think people would try and like play with Junebug. And like the thing about Junebug is if you install Advance It. So that's 3 clicks, 2 credits. And the runner runs it. And they take 4 net damage. 4 net damage is at worst 4 clicks. So you're basically, then the runner is generally a better able to like counteract this. And Snare is also actually like a similar value. So if you don't have the econ to justify it, you're not actually coming out that ahead, especially in like the early environment where you have bad ice, bad econ, and these traps don't really have a way to deal with that. So things kind of change here with basically the big card that changes the dynamics of trash is Mushin Notion, which basically now they run it and they take 6 net damage and you've spent 2 clicks and no credits. And now it's a pretty good value trade, as well as you pass over a certain threshold of your trap where it's actually pretty reasonable to kill them. And so the core of this deck is it's running 12 agendas. Fetals, which are pretty good because they're taking 3 net, pretty good at setting up kills, basically a snare you don't have to pay for. Giyahan's Arcology, about as good as the money gets. It's pretty bad, but it's better than nothing. House of Knives, 3 of them. Basically, this is the best card in your deck. Is really just sort of, if they don't check it, then you get basically 4 net damage, including now the runner has to always run accesses with four cards in hand instead of 3, because otherwise they can die to snare. And really sort of compresses what they can do. There was this idea of click compression, where, okay, what Jinteki is basically saying can do is say, hey, even though you have way more money than me, you can only save up 5 cards in hand. So if you need to deal with sort of 6 net damage in a turn, it becomes pretty hard to do a lot. If you need to like install and steal like a fetal AI or be able to deal with a snare, that you become pretty limited in what you're able to do. And so basically, and then you have Philotic, which is totally busted and will like basically kind of just like win you like one game out of 10 or so, one game out of 20 maybe on the spot, and is also worth 3 points. And then it's two future perfect, just really, really strong agenda. One of the big things that made Jinteki playable is having access to this. And then when we go into, I think the next important set of cards to talk about are the traps as well as Ronin. And so you have three Overriders, three Ronins. And so you probably mix, you probably, pretty much how Jinteki works is like, if you have motion and you have something, you kind of need to put it out on the table. And you're giving the runner kind of a 50-50, whether it's a Zephyr Overrider, at which point, if you take three Brain, you're pretty much dead against this deck. And if you leave a Ronin up on the board, you have to end every turn at three. So if you say you start with five cards in hand and you hit a snare, you need to draw to not die, or draw to not die to Neural Ronin, which really limits what you can do on every turn. And it makes it pretty easy to die if you're not incredibly careful. You know, the Corp is really able to control what you're able to do, because like, okay, I have a Ronin. They don't know I have a Ronin. If they steal this, like a fetal AI, then they're going to take a bunch of net and I'll be able to kill them. You can additionally Mushin TFP. I think Dan talked about Mushin a lot at the time and mostly scoring on points, because 3 points is really good. And then traps, basically, you have Psychic Fields and Snares, and the original list had one Shikyu. I think Shikyu is mostly cut after this, though is like pretty good, but the deck just really doesn't have the money to deal with it, to use it. And so basically you have like seven never advanced cards that you want to score: the House of Knives, the Gi Hands, and the Philotic. And you have six traps, Snares and Psychic Fields, with Psychic Fields being the best one. And so sort of the runner is kind of like has to be prepared to be like, hey, I want to check these to keep plan around. Okay, if they beat me on Centrals, I need to score House of Knives, and then I'm able to kill them as soon as they hit a snare, stuff like that. Money-wise, things are bad. You have three hedge funds, two diversified portfolio. That is the money in the deck. And I think the diversified portfolio are a little aggressive. I think you're pretty typically not going to be getting much more than hedge fund value out of them, and a lot of times, not even that. And I think it's like the big weak point of this deck is that you're kind of vulnerable to Siphon. It's actually running a Scorched Earth to sort of be able to kill people who siphon you and don't clear tags, which I think makes a lot of sense. I think after this, there was a lot of PE decks would be cutting it, and sort of you never really knew if they were running Scorch, and they were sort of getting herd immunity. Again, a little bit of the scouting difference. And they get two Neural EMPs, which sort of gets back to this idea that you want to be able to kill them if they end on out of cards, usually combined with Ronin. I think I actually saw Kenji's game against Niles, where he kills them with three Neurals. So his list was probably a little bit different than this. Another notable card that almost certainly got cut for Kenji's list was Zaya Batsu Loyalty, the exposed counter, but is a pretty bad card. Ice-wise, you got two Eli, which I think for the most part people are going to be playing three Eli's after this. Just totally, totally broken card. You have three Ugura and three Pup, basically really cheap ice that is kind of annoying and kind of needs to be dealt with, and usually taxing around net damage. I think the ice and money is a big weakness of this deck. As you can see, you can just blind siphon against this deck, which is a huge problem. And I don't totally know how Kenji adapted around that. I would guess he probably played like slightly more money cards, though it's kind of hard to find them, and maybe slightly more ice. But I think this deck has some vulnerabilities to people learning how to play against it, though there's a lot it does that's very powerful. And then on the runner side, we have Kenji's actual corp. Actual runner, which is Noise. This is the only Anarch in the top 16, despite Noise having been 20% of the field. So you can see it generally underperformed. One aspect of that, I think, is that people were generally not 100% sure how to build Noise. He'd kind of been around for a while, had taken a big hit with Jackson, And right before this world had gotten a bunch of tools, but no one had really won with noise. I think the biggest thing he got was Cash, David, as well as Inject. If you read the thread, there's a lot of argument about whether or not Inject is good. I think it's pretty certainly good. I think Noise really struggles if you don't find Aesops, and Inject is a pretty good card. Though I think there's a lot of disagreement at the time if Inject is good or not. Its value gets a lot worse when you have a lot of programs because you're trying to draw cards. Is like the you'd rather have cards than credit, and you know you don't want to be. Noise also often hits the end of his deck, and I think this Noise is pretty recognizable to later stuff. It's playing most of the good viruses at the time: 3 Data Sucker, 2 Medium, 3 Parasite, 3 Imp, 3 Cash. And some interesting ones are it has 3 Cyberfeeder and 3 Shahrazad, which I think generally would be cut later than this or played as a one time each. It's playing 3 Deja Vu, which was pretty standard, just sort of the ability to get Parasite plus like a cash back is really good value, or even 2 caches, and you have a lot of options and flexibility. As the influence is playing 3 Aesop's Pawn Shop, which is the most important card in the deck. It's playing 3 Clone Ship, which I think is generally what people played until the NWL hits. One of the keys about this deck is really you want to be parasiting as much ice as possible. You don't really want to be breaking things. And you have a lot of tools to threaten different servers. You know, obviously remotes get threatened by you steal the points they put there. Ace Q gets threatened by Imp at this time. Then notably, I think this deck should almost certainly be playing 3 Lamprey, which is a really good noise card that was not really recognized for its strength this time, and how important getting that central threat where you're spreading them thin with Parasite, and if they don't deal with Lamprey, they'll sort of get run over. And you know, oftentimes if you don't have any ice and Noise has a Lamprey installed, you kind of have to purge in response, otherwise you're going broke and they get 3 accesses and you lose 3 credits, and then like you can they get a it just anytime Noise stalls the game, it's good because he's just generating so much value as the game goes along. Hardware, basically you got 1 Plascrete. I think it makes sense actually. Noise is generally pretty poor. Even though he has imps to maybe trash the kill pieces, he's generally going to be C-scores don't have a lot of ability to outmoney the corp. Though I think you can probably just outvalue Wayland. Wayland doesn't have audacity this time, isn't that fast. But I think at the time people thought Wayland was pretty fast, but it's actually pretty hard to like deal with a noise that just sat there and didn't do anything. It's got wild sides, and this is before Chronotype. So I think it's worth it, but it's a huge vulnerability, especially against like an RP. That you have a lot of good stuff against RP. Parasite is very good against the RP list at the time. And you got 2 Grimoire, which I think was almost the only console you could play at the time in Anarch. Though Anarch ended up getting a lot of interesting, cool consoles later. And I think it was pretty much always the console Noise played. You know, playing a lot of viruses, have a lot of memims, and the virus counter is pretty valuable. Extra credit from Cash, Parasite's faster, Medium's better, Imp's better. And then an interesting one is the Icebreaker was Crypsis 3 times. I think I don't love Crypsis. It's pretty bad. Noise doesn't really have an engine. But I think the truth is you're mainly focusing on using Parasite, and Crypsis is really good around the fringe cases. And you don't really want to be breaking a lot of stuff with Crypsis. I think later the Ice Suite before Faust was 2 Knights, a Mimic, and a Corroder, which I think is probably what should be played here. And then you make 1 cut to fill up the slot. So I think the things... Oh, and then the other thing is this is Nerve Agent. Nerve Agent's pretty bad. I think it's pretty important to understand why Medium is great and Nerve Agent is bad. In that, let's say you install Nerve Agent, run HQ 3 times. So you see 1 card, 2 cards, 3 cards. So you've probably seen almost all of the HQ cards. You're maybe missing 1. I think on average, you probably see 4 out of 5. Especially if there's any, if you trash anything, you're going to see them all, basically. And so on the next turn, the runner, the corp draws a card. Okay, they can just like install it in a remote. Whereas with Medium, if you see 3 cards, they kind of have to respond to this threat. Otherwise, you're going to see 7 cards in your next turn. And it just, Medium can really take over the game in a way Nerve Agent can't. And it's like a threat that the Corp has to respond to right away. And so there's just, even though you're trying to beat NEH, it's pretty slow. And I think this would have been better as like Lamprey. And it's just is a way better HQ presser because it forces that purge if you're able to get in for free. But yeah, I think there's a lot of, I think this noise list is pretty close. I think the big thing, if you were coming back now, you want to test with Lamprey and probably the Breaker set I'd talk about. But I think this noise list is a pretty good starting point. You know, I think noise ends up being one of the best decks about a year from now, but it gets three things, four things actually. It's Clot, which really makes the NEH matchup actually good. It makes Chronotype, which is a huge power card. Gets Faust, which actually lets you break ice well. And it gets Street Peddler, which is kind of better than Inject for the most part in Noise, though sometimes people would play both. But yeah, I think Noise is probably not as good, though I don't know enough about what the NEH matchup is like without having played it without Clot. Because basically what happens later in the NEH matchup is Noise would get set up. NEH would usually get like 5 points, and then Noise would just Deja Vu Clot out every turn. And just get a ton of value and then run archives and win. And I think it was actually a pretty good matchup for Noise, though it took a lot of people to realize that it was a good matchup for Noise, because Noise is able to slow NEH down enough that they got to a state where they just played Clot every turn. All right, then up next, rounding out the people at 1-2 is Scott Pagliarone, aka Spags. So I think the first thing to say about Spags is he is pretty unquestionably the greatest Netrunner poster of all time. I was reading through a lot of this stuff going back to the Board Game Geek days. He's in all the threads, stirring shit up, you know, or on the sidelines, eating popcorn. You know, if you look at the stats on StimHack forums, he's just sort of all over the board. Most likes, most post likes, got a ton of posts, got a lot of great posts. You know, and then this continued into the Slack era, where he's an extremely well-known poster, sort of, he's a cool dad. Remember him sharing photos with Iggy Azalea, the radio station he works with. You know, isn't trying too hard, but is still just effortlessly cool. You know, in this tournament, he's playing with a Macho Man Randy Savage playmat, where he's body slamming Jesus. Just top to bottom funny guy. Shares a lot of great old card game stories, like stealing Gen Gun passes to back in the day with like a photocopy or something, probably a fax machine, given the time period we're talking about. Yeah, he wrote a Worlds report that's extremely funny. You know, I've talked a little bit about how a lot of the people talking about Worlds and how much fun it is at the time. It's the thing that got me into Netrunner, and I think I remember reading this and being like, wow, that sounds like so much fun, I want to do that. On top of that, he's just sort of an amazing hype man. You know, when I asked him about this, the first thing he told me was Aaron Andrews was robbed. Aaron Andrews was the bubble boy at 17, and sort of, you know, pretty much everyone who goes 17 at tournament will tell you about how close they are, how could have been. But it's a good friend that will tell you about how their friend was robbed at 17. And he's like, you know, super buys were so stupid. Aaron Andrews should have made it. He's a great player, he would have won. Just really, really hyping his friends up. And then when I asked him about Andy Shibushki, who was the other top 16 member from Wisconsin, Spag State, he told me all about how great he was, about how the Wisconsin meta was the all-time greatest card gaming region of all time. Just, you know, everything. He was just like, oh yeah, Wisconsin, we had the best everything forever, you know. You know, which is great guy, you know, really, really, really enthusiastic, hype people up, hype his friends up, hype himself up. And I think, you know, with all of this, I think he's well known for a lot of this kind of stuff. You know, my own long-term figure, he's also done a bunch of stuff at the NRPC, organized a bunch of tournaments, organized King of Servers. And I think a lot of this overshadows the fact that he's actually tied for the most top 16s at Worlds. The one of them was 2013 Worlds. And then this one, and then he would later get two more, which is, I think, there's only two people who have done that, which is, you know, quite an achievement. He has a bunch of other, you know, pretty solid performances. And I think it really gets overshadowed by the fact that he's such a prolific and funny guy. So yeah, you know, I think I've hyped them up enough. It's a really, really nice guy, and I talked to him a bunch when I remember when he first talked to me, and I was like, man, I can't believe this guy knows who I am. 2015 Worlds. Then we'll get into his decks. First off is his NEH deck, which I would describe as like sort of the canonical NEH deck. It's for the influence, it's 3x Architect, 3x Eli, 2x Biotic, that's 17. Same agendas we've talked about, you know, 16 ice, same sort of set of stuff. Pop-ups, a couple gear checks, in this case Quandary. Eli's, the wraparounds. He's running Pads and Marked and Jackson like most of the other people we've seen so far. 2x Fast Track, 3x Sweeps, 3x Hedge. Sort of same stuff. I think the most interesting thing about this list is 2x Tollbooth. I think for the most part, people would end up moving off of 2x Tollbooth, usually running one. Though I think it gives you like a really taxing end game, usually an R&D, where you've scored like an Astro 2, you're probably on 5 points, and you need to draw on the last points to score it. I think you don't totally need it in this environment, but I think, but I don't 100% know what you replace it with. So yeah, it seems fine. Not the end of the world. Really just the baseline NEH deck if you think about NEH at the time. And I think it's pretty good. You know, I think it's well tuned. There's maybe some arguments for some of the NEH decks we'll see later that are sort of doing more interesting things. But I think I would just play this one if I was going to play NEH at this tournament. And then on the runner side, we have Prepaid Gate. As I mentioned earlier, he's the original creator of... I'm going to pull up the original list because I think there's some interesting things in it. I mentioned it another time, 2x Public Sympathy. I was originally running the Procos, which I think was a long-running argument on Netrunner. But other than that, it's pretty much what you would see in later Prepaid Gates. 3 Dirty Laundry, 3 Lucky Find, 3 Cheer Gamble. 3 Maker's Eye is like the main multi-axis. And then in his actual list for the time, I think this list is pretty well-tuned. 3 Diesel, 2 Quality Time, I think that makes sense. It's got 2 Legwork, as I was saying. Really the key to being any each of the time is Legwork. It's got 2 Plascreed and a Dyson Mem Chip. I don't know about these. I would just make these Proco. You know, you can beat any deck trying to scorch you with more money. And I don't know what this Dyson Mem Chip is doing, but it's fine. It's just one slot. 3 Clone Chip, 3 Prepaid. But interestingly enough, he's got 3 R&D Interface and only 1 Maker's Eye. I think probably, you know, looking to R&D lock people, I think without Proco, it's going to be hard to R&D lock RP in this environment, but I would say maybe even cutting the dice into the Plascreed for more makers makes a lot of sense to me. But I think that's the main like weakness of this one as opposed to the other previous list is a sort of lack of multi-axis relative to them, which I think hurt his NEH matchup, and that's how he ended up losing. He lost twice to NEH in the cut. You know, pretty way to go. Like I was saying, there's gonna be a lot of people at the bottom who only lost runner games. And it's hard to 100% count them out. His Icebreakers, Mimic, Zoo, Snowball, Deus Ex, Atman, Sharpshooter, sort of what I originally talking about, like sort of the toolbox where you can play, hey, if you need to, you can play Deus Ex a bunch of time, LBBP, you can play Sharpshooter a bunch of times to not get caught out. He's got 2 Data Suckers. I think this should just be 1 Data Sucker and 1 Stim Hack. I think the Stim Hack is really good, especially against any age trash, the early Sansan. He's got 1 Parasite, which I think is going to give him a lot better RP matchup. It makes a lot of sense. You know, if you consider his field and what he's end up going to have to beat. And he's only got 1 Same Old Thing, which I was really happy to see this because it just makes way more sense than 3 Same Old Thing. I don't know what they were doing. But yeah, I think this is the list I'd start with. I think there's some like minor improvements you can make with either putting Proko in or more Maker's Eye for some cutting some of the not as good cards. Maybe even a 3rd Astrolaborer to help out with the NEH matchup because that card really helps you a lot. You know, it's probably like 4 or 5 draws in a typical NEH game. But yeah, I think this is a pretty good list. As I was saying, Snowmall really makes me not want to play this because just breaking Eli for 5 is something I don't really want to do, though you can admin at 4 or as well as having Parasite, but I don't know. I think Snowmall is a huge weak point relative to this deck gets with Lady. One other thing I'll say about this is I think pretty much everyone I talked to about this was like, oh, I could have won. I was close. I think Spags is a pretty credible case about this. He lost twice on runner sides against NEH, you know, with notably in Winners, where if he wins, he has a 50-50 Corp against Dan, both of which are reasonable matchups. I think this K deck is pretty well tuned to beat RP, especially as I'll talk about. I think Dan's RP deck has some problems, especially against a deck like this, to beat the Parasites. You know, and he lost to Andy Shibushki on an NAPD. He told me he accessed it on 3. He actually accessed it on 0, but you know, memory is a fickle thing. And I think he has a pretty good case. He was in a good position to take this, you know, because his deck feels like it has a good RP matchup, a good PE matchup, and really a key thing to being able to win this tournament is to be able to beat one or two Corp games, and then, you know, ideally win out with your Corp. But yeah, that was Bag Decks. I think I'm gonna cut this episode off here because I'm noticing it's getting really long, and I'll cut out the top 8 into a second, third episode, I guess it will be. For anyone who was silly enough to listen to almost 2 hours of this, there will probably be another hour and a half for this, where I talk about the top 8, and then I'll finish it off with a final episode where I have some closing thoughts, some game recommendations. But I really hope people, if they're going to listen to this, because I feel like it's a really, you know, and I'm not going to give timestamps so people can't just skip to the favorite players they know, because I want to give a shout out to the people may not remember, especially like Niles, who is a early figure. But I also recognize that this is an almost unlistenable podcast, and a lot of people aren't going to have made it to this point. But you know, if you tell me that you have, I'll be impressed, and I'll, you know, just message me, and I'll probably respond if you manage to get to this point.